The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and on the Breakfast Grill today we have Pascal Lamy, one-time Director General of the World Trade Organization, author of two books, one entitled The Geneva Consensus, Making Trade Work for All, and also Honorary President of the Paris-based think tank Notre Europe. We're here at the Intercontinental Kuala Lumpur. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I want to begin with the fact that you wear many hats, and one of them is as an interministerial delegate for the 2025 World Expo. And apart from your native France, three other countries are vying for this honor: Japan, Russia, and Azerbaijan. I want to ask you, why Paris, why France?
Why Paris, why France? A, because we want to remain connected to our past. And France was a very successful organizer of universal expos in the 19th century. And B, we want to connect with our future. So we want to build that bridge between what we did in the 19th century and what we want to do in the 21st century.
Okay. Emmanuel Macron, who's the president of the Republic, and I'm going to quote him here, says, "The World Expo is a chance for our country to contribute to a new universal ambition, build on our past to embrace the future, and harness globalization, an aspiration shared by our citizens, as well as the peoples of other nations." Wonderful words, but it does seem to go against perhaps the grain in some segments of European society, the populist politics that we've seen, the rise of anti-globalization protests. Where do you place this ambition to be part of or lead a global conversation against that background?
Well, Emmanuel Macron, I think, is a living example of how to fight populism. He was elected against a full-fledged populist candidate. And the agenda he develops for the 2025 exhibitions, whether he will still be president of France by that time is an open question, is precisely that globalization needs to be harnessed. Unchecked, unfettered globalization may lead to economic and social pain that then creates a ground for populist movement to instrumentalize public discontent. And we know that globalization, trade opening, works because it's painful, and it's painful because it works. So the philosophy behind this, which is quite a traditional French philosophy for a long time, is that, yes, you need economic reform, yes, you need structural reform, yes, you need trade opening, but you need social systems, and you need to care about the environmental impact of this economic development process.
Do you think the political elite of Europe are up to the task of doing precisely that? This populist wave is not going to go away, even with Macron's victory. We see perhaps with the upcoming Italian elections, we'll see yet another test of the strength of the idea of a united Europe, the strength of this openness to the world.
Yeah, my answer to that is we have problems, but so far these problems have been addressed and the populist surge has been contained in Europe. And that is very different to what we've seen in the US. So the difference between US and EU is not that we have populist surges or populist appeals. We have this in both cases, but continental Europe has resisted this in Austria, in France, in the Netherlands. We will see where Italian elections go this year, but so far we've been better at resisting or containing these pulsions. I'm not saying that will always be the case. I'm saying the European system, this social market economy, is probably better than the U.S. system at coping with the difficulties.
Now, Europe has, since the end of the Pacific War, hitched itself to America. And there was, it seems, some sort of transatlantic consensus, Europe and America pushing in the same direction largely. You rightly point out the rise of Donald Trump, but also just the entire shift against globalization. Hillary Clinton was not in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for instance. Is this the end of that partnership between Europe and continental America in terms of dealing with global issues?
I mean, nothing surprising that the moment half of the world economy is elsewhere than Europe and US, and notably thanks to the development of China, India, Asian countries, Latin America, there's no surprise, at least in my view, that the transatlantic partnership which has shaped international life after the Second World War has to shift. There are various ways to do this, with or without American leadership. We seem to be in a period where American leadership is retreating. It's for others, including Europeans, to fill the gap and have, with other emerging countries, the kind of cooperative, challenge-addressing and attitude, which is why, again, we've taken as a theme for our 2025 Universal Expo bid, knowledge to share, planet to care, because we believe this is a consensus. True, U.S., or more precisely, the U.S. president is departing from this consensus. As far as I know, California is not.
Yes, I believe Arnold Schwarzenegger was seen cycling around Paris at some point in time last year. I want to remain on the question of Europe and the ideals that the European Union embodies. What real problems are there in that conception of European unity? Do you think it moved too fast, too quickly, or it was too ambitious? And is there a need for it to scale down? And what kind of regionalisms are possible? I mean, in Southeast Asia, we have a form of regionalism too, very different from the European Union.
There are various ways to address global challenges which globalization brings to humanity. Take environment, take pandemics, take issues like the digital civilization divide, take robots, take nanotechnologies. We all have to face with the same problems. Now, there is a way to do that globally. Tough, complex, getting agreement between 200 member states, a very different philosophical provenances, spiritual traditions, economic development is very tough. So regionalism is not the solution. It's the second best as compared to the multilateral global approach. But it can work because you naturally have more understanding and connection with your neighbors than you have with foreigners. That's a human reality. So I am a deep believer in regionalism, not just because I served, including European institutions, during 15 years of my life, but because I believe that's the way to go. Now, is it working everywhere? No. It works better in ASEAN than in the Mercosur in Latin America, and it works better in Eastern Africa than in the Gulf countries. Why is it so? A, because there is a different level of political commitment, of political determination, of consistency. B, because institutional setups are different. Now, that's the way to go. I believe, by the way, ASEAN, and I've been working for ASEAN for the last, 25 years of my life, ASEAN is among the integration animals on this planet today, is a relatively successful endeavor, although it's done in a very pragmatic Asian way rather than the big European institutional way. Now, the big question behind these regional integration systems, and this is where Europe is a very both interesting and challenging case, is whether economic integration brings political integration. Now, in the case of Europe, the founding fathers thought that in uniting economies, you would unite people within a new political entity, a new demos, as the Greek says. And the reality is that building a brand new political system which people feel they belong to is more complex than uniting markets. There is a symbolic element, a sort of mental, emotional input in the fact that you belong to a community which you don't create just by uniting markets. And this is something which we know for sure in Europe now. We need to address this through various ways, because a new political space needs legitimacy, And this legitimacy has to do with the feeling of belonging. And this is also a lesson for countries in the ASEAN. One day in the future, they will have to go deeper than just harmonizing customs or medicine marketing regulations.
I'm speaking to Pascal Lamy, one-time Director General of the World Trade Organization. Next up, we speak about his book, The Geneva Consensus, Making Trade Work for All. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and our guest this morning on The Breakfast Grill is Pascal Lamy, one-time Director General of the World Trade Organization. That was from the year 2005 to 2013, and the author of the book, The Geneva Consensus, Making Trade Work for All. As Director General of the World Trade Organization, you chaired the Doha Rounds of Negotiations. I believe you're also one of the people instrumental in pushing for the Doha talks. It forms the basis of your reflections in the book, if I understand correctly. What is the central argument of your book, if you can explain that to us?
My central argument, which stems both from theory and experience, is that opening trade works for growth, for welfare, but it works under some conditions that have to be there in order to make trade work for all. And I depart from that, from the essentially liberal view that open trade and God will take care of the rest. I believe opening trade is efficiency creating for reasons that have to do with the fact that if I do something better than you do and you do something better than I do, I'd better buy from you what you do better than I do and the other way around. We will both be better off. I will benefit from your knowledge, your know-how. You will benefit from mine. And this is a rational trade-off, which is good for both of us. Now, this is why trade opening works. But the people on your side who are doing what I do and the people on my side who are doing what you do won't be pleased. They'll have to adjust. They'll have to change. They'll have to adjust. I will take from you what I took from them and the other way around. This is painful for them, which is why trade opening needs to go with policies, with structures, with institutions that address the problems of the losers. There are more winners than losers, but this is not a convincing argument for the losers.
Is this an article of faith? Is this an ideological commitment? Or has it been borne out with evidence that, in fact, there are more winners than there are losers?
No, we know for sure that there are more winners than losers. Look at how globalization and trade opening has shrunk poverty on this planet for the last 30 years. The numbers are there. But we also know that these has been together with an increase in inequalities in many countries that then can lead to social malaise, frustration, and that's something that needs to be coped with. Now, if you want an evidence of the linkage between trade opening and social systems, look at polls where you ask the question, do you think open trade is good for your country? The correlation between yes and a strong social system is extremely high. And if you go back to the present situation in Europe or US, in my view, the reason why you will not have a Trump in Europe is that we have a social system that addresses the shock, the impact of globalization and trade opening, which is better than the US one. And look at the numbers.
And this is, would you be referring to kind of social democratic model of governance and social equality?
Absolutely, which is, you know, which is what we learned in Europe from the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. We knew it was great. We knew it killed a lot of jobs. We knew it created a lot of jobs. But we know that this transfer from the jobs that are killed to the ones that are created is socially painful and needs proper public policies, education, industry, technology, research, regional policy, a proper labor market, a proper adjustment for unemployment when people have to be temporarily unemployed. It is a very complex system. And most of that has nothing to do with trade policy. Your trade policy has to be open, but your domestic policy has to be able to cope with creating these efficiencies.
I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you also advocate a coherence of policies, not just at the national level, but an international level. In fact, in some ways, you're pushing for more world government, as it were, or coherence on a global scale. And that be an adequate characterization of your argument?
This is correct, although I would hate a world government.
Why would you hate a world government?
Because I think that would be very dangerous. We need diversity. We need, even trade opening is built on the notion that there is diversity. We can trade because we don't do the same thing. We can trade. We get a lot of benefit from trade because we are dissimilar. But I agree with you that as globalization integrates more and more our economic and to some extent our social systems, we need better collective ways to address this. Now, we have international institutions. We have the World Trade Organization. We have the World Bank. We have the International Monetary Fund. We have the International Telecommunication Union, the International Labor Union. We have a number of these. But true, they often do not act in coherence. And the reason why they do not act in coherence is because they are member-driven. It's sovereigns, it's 200 sovereigns that drive these organizations, but the definition they have of their sovereignty is that sovereignty is the right not to be coherent. So my sovereignty allows me to say something in the WTO and to say something different in the ILO or to say something different in the World Bank. This is where the incoherence from the present international system, this is where it comes from. And we have to make sure that citizens, who are the ones that determine who their leaders are, make them accountability of their coherence. And there are very few systems in this planet, except in high parliamentary control systems, where this coherence checks, this coherence accountability really works.
Now, we'll speak about the WTO, since you had an important role to play in it. Now, it's observed, it's noted by observers that the ministerial declaration that was adopted at the start of the Doha Development Round around November 2001 was a promising response to anti-globalization riots of the 1990s. That's what it said. The same observers 10 years on say they're less sanguine about what the WTO achieved. And, you know, there's a long list of what these critics will say are the failures of the WTO. I mean, where do you put the WTO in terms of its ability to actually not just form a kind of consensus, but actually deliver on the promises that it makes?
Well,
especially for the developing world, I think.
Absolutely. What WTO, I mean, the fundamental purpose of WTO is opening trade and keeping trade open. So if you want to judge whether WTO has been successful or not, you have to answer the question, is trade more open today than yesterday? And the answer is yes. And was it more open yesterday than the day before? The answer is yes. Trade keeps opening, and that's the result which we are all looking for. Whether it's opening thanks to the multilateral trading system, which is the WTO, whether it's about regional trading system like ASEAN, like the European Union, whether it's about bilateral deals like the one Malaysia could sign with the European Union in the future, or whether it's just by unilateral opening of your market, don't mind the color of the cat, provided it catches mice.
Oh, you're quoting Deng Xiaoping there.
Absolutely, and I'm a big fan of Deng Xiaoping, who is one of the main leaders of contemporary times, in my view. So,
but are all members of this member state, you say, consensus-driven, are they equal? Because the criticism is that the G20, in particular, has embarked on a series of protectionist measures since the WTO discussions that have protected their markets. Think of the agricultural subsidies that are given to the G20 and such. So this is the charge in these.
Let's go back to the fundamentals. When the Doha Declaration was signed, which is, as you said, November 2001, the critic to globalization was it was bad for developing countries. The people demonstrating in the streets of Seattle were demonstrating in the name of poor countries. They were wrong. What's happened since is that trade opening has immensely benefited developing countries. And by the way, the problem we have now with globalization and anti-globalization is not in developing countries. It's in developed countries. So that is the best evidence that the system has worked for developing countries, to the cost, by the way, some problems in developed countries, which I think we should now recognize. Now, does this mean that agricultural trade is properly disciplined and regulated today? No. The US, China, to some extent Europe, still subsidize their farming sector too much, and this is to the detriment of African countries. But the only way to change this is to make sure that US, China, and EU, for instance, agree that agricultural subsidies should be lowered. We are not yet there.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Pascal Lamy, one-time Director General of the World Trade Organization, author of the book The Geneva Consensus, Making Trade Work for All, and honorary President of the Paris-based think tank Notre Europe. I'm Sharad Kutan, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.